The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm going to try that again. Good evening, everyone. All right, and welcome to Parkway Central. I'm Siobhan Reardon. I'm the President and Director of the Free Library of Philadelphia, and welcome to our Montgomery Auditorium and tonight's lecture. A bit of housekeeping before we begin the lecture tonight. I need you to silence your cell phones or whatever device, and then maybe you'll tweet or send somebody a little message saying you're here and you're about to hear Tracy. As many of you know, the Free Library provides essential services throughout the year that support hundreds of thousands of individuals. These services are especially important during the stressful economic times we're now going through. Job seekers increasingly depend on our free computers and internet access to search and apply for jobs. We're approaching nearly 1,000 people a day are coming in and using our public computers for this reason. And libraries throughout Philadelphia all continue to offer a safe environment for students seeking after-school homework help. We offer something for everyone. History buffs love our social sciences and history division, as well as our rare book department. And we give you tours weekdays at 11 o'clock if you're interested to take a look at what's up in our rare book collection. I highly recommend it. Tonight's special guest is known for transporting readers to another era. Tracy Chevalier is the author of the international best-selling Girl with a Pearl Earring. Have we all read it? Absolutely. Which was based on the creation of the famous painting by Johan Vermeer. The mesmerizing tale was later adapted into an award-winning film starring Colin Firth and Scarlett Johansson. Ms. Chevalier followed that novel with Falling Angels, another one we all read, right? Lady and the Unicorn, and Burning Bright. Her newest novel, Remarkable Creatures, is based on the life of the 19th century English fossil collector Mary Anning, who discovered the first complete specimen of the ichthyosaur, giant marine reptiles that disappeared 25 million before dinosaurs became extinct. In danger of being an outcast for her working class background, Mary forms an unlikely friendship with Elizabeth Philpott, a spinster with a passion for fossils. The British newspaper, The Guardian, deems it a stunning story, and The Telegraph calls it a book with impressive scope. We are honored to have her with us this evening. And ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tracy Chevalier.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be here. I adore libraries, so I was thrilled when I found out I'd be talking at the Free Library. I began my career as a reader, going to the public library every week as a kid, getting a big stack of books, and always one special one from the children's librarian because I was her pet, and she would try things out on me, and when she thought I was ready for a little romance or a little science fiction, she would get me there. And I have a lot to thank Mrs. Carney for, because I think it's my love of books that maybe go on to become a writer as well as a reader. I think libraries are an amazing invention, and they are a sign of a civilized society, and long may they last. Yes, well done. Now, I'm going to talk tonight about my book and read four sections from it, some short, some longer, and then I'll be very happy to take questions from the audience. And I particularly love that bit because I never know what you're going to ask me, and it's often quite interesting. In the other night in New York, somebody asked me if I believe there was life on other planets. And I said, because I wrote about fossils, so go figure. But I said to him, I don't really have an opinion about it, but I bet you do. So he proceeded to tell us all about his belief as there is, yes. I'm also going to illustrate the talk and reading a bit. And I sometimes wrestle with PowerPoint, so you can have a good laugh at my expense. But hopefully it'll enhance rather than detract. I'm going to start with the inspiration, with what made me fall in love with the character I wrote about. And it also describes a little bit about how I come up with ideas. Lightning has struck me all my life. Just once was it real. I shouldn't remember it, for I was little more than a baby. But I do remember. I was in a field where there were horses and riders performing tricks. Then a storm blew in, and a woman picked me up and brought me under a tree. As she held me tight, I looked up and saw the pattern of black leaves against a white sky. Then there was a noise, like all the trees falling down round me, and a bright, bright light, which was like looking at the sun. A buzz ran right through me. It was as if I'd touched a hot coal, and I could smell singed flesh and sense there was pain, yet it weren't painful. I felt like a stocking turned inside out. Others began pulling at me and calling, but I couldn't make a sound. I was carried somewhere. Then there was warmth all round, not a blanket, but wet. I knew where I was, because it was water, and I knew water. Our house was close to the sea. I could see it from our windows. Then I opened my eyes, and it feels like they haven't been shut since. The lightning killed the woman holding me, and two girls standing next to her, but I survived. They say I was a quiet, sickly child before the storm, but after it, I grew up lively and alert. I can't say if they're right, but the memory of that lightning still runs through me like a shiver. It marks powerful moments of my life, seeing the first crocodile skull my brother found and finding its body myself, discovering other monsters on the beach, meeting all the men. Other times I'll feel the lightning strike and wonder why it's come. Sometimes I don't understand, but accept what the lightning tells me, for the lightning is me. It entered me when I was a baby and never left. I feel an echo of the lightning each time I find a fossil, a little jolt that says, "Yes, Mary Anning, you are different from all the rocks on the beach." That's why I'm a hunter, to feel that bolt of lightning and that difference every day. So my inspiration for this book started out with a bolt of lightning too, but a figurative one. I haven't been struck by lightning and survived. I was at a dinosaur museum with my son, who was 7 at the time. It was a little museum in the south of England. And in one corner, I saw a little display of a woman. Now, this is me in the summer doing a publicity shot for when it came out in England. This is the sort of thing they have us do. They said, "We want you with this, with the mannequin, or the lady." And this is the corner of the dinosaur museum where I had a look. I read all that stuff. This is a few years ago. I had never heard of Mary Anning, but I discovered that she was a working class woman who was called the best fossil hunter the world has ever known. She was working in an arena which was dominated by middle-class men, and that was the first thing I noticed about her, is that she was really very much out on a limb. She was doing her own thing, deeply eccentric. And she discovered when she was only 11 years old, in the winter of 1810-11, she and her brother discovered the first complete specimen of what we call an ichthyosaur. Looks something like this. Oh, no, there she is, actually. I told you I would... Here we go. It all starts now. Okay, and another one of her. That's actually a sketch done by a friend of hers later in her life. And I was always amused by this because she wore a top hat to protect her from falling rocks. But that's on the beach. Okay, now comes the ichthyosaur. See, the thing is, when I talk, I tend to go off on tangents, and then the images have to bring me back, so it's always a bit of a surprise. This is an ichthyosaur, and when they found it, the word dinosaur hadn't even been invented. They had absolutely no idea that such a creature existed. Later in her life, she discovered a plesiosaur, and this is the specimen she discovered. This is about 24 feet long. It's really huge. Again, it was a creature, ancient marine reptile, 200 million years old, but she had no idea what it was, the star that she was finding. Now, she grew up in a working class family, and her father was a cabinet maker. They were always very poor, and so he supplemented his income, with selling fossils to visitors. He used to go out on the beach, and he taught his children to find fossils, and they'd had a little workshop. In front of the workshop, they'd set out a table with all the things that they had found, and they sold this in a town called Lyme Regis, which is on the south coast of England. This is it today, but it still looks very much like that if you just strip away all the cars. It's still very much a tourist town. It's right on the seaside, so there's a lot of people come down, and a lot of people came down in the early 19th century as a tourist destination. Especially middle-class families who had been going around the country. They'd go to Bath for the season in the summer, and then in September, October, they would come down to Lyme Regis to swim in the sea and drink the seawater because it was supposed to be good for you at the time, or so they said. This also, of the people, the most illustrious of the visitors was Jane Austen, who came to Lyme Regis in 1803 and liked it so much they came in 1804. And she, in fact, set some of Persuasion there. If you've read Persuasion, Lyme Regis is the town where Louisa Musgrove jumps off of a jetty and hurts herself, and they have to stay in Lyme Regis for a time. It's also possibly best known to us as the setting for The French Lieutenant's Woman, John Fowles' novel and then later the film. So if you remember Meryl Streep with her cloak, she's standing at the end of a curved jetty called the Cobb, and she's doing her romantic thing. That's Lyme Regis. But there's another side to Lyme Regis, maybe a more scientific side that you might not know about. And you wouldn't know, you might buy a couple of fossils in town, but if you don't go to the other beach, the wilder beach around the corner, you wouldn't know that actually there's a completely different geological and paleontological side of Lyme Regis. Now, in this map, Lyme Regis, if you see, is down here at the south, sorry. Ah, yes, me and technology were great. Okay, so never mind, doesn't matter. If you see the purple seam, that is a seam of Jurassic limestone, 200 million years old, with all the right conditions to create a lot of fossils. And it comes out in the northeast of the map at Scarborough, and down at the south at Lyme Regis. Those two places where it hits the sea, lots of fossils tumble out onto the beach. And so it's always been rich pickings for fossil hunters, and it still is. The sort of fossils you find are, this is actually the beach. These are called Church Cliffs. This is where Mary Anning and her brother found the first ichthyosaur. And further along, that's called Black Venn, this kind of landslide that's occurred over thousands of years. Although those people on the beach are looking for fossils right now, or pretending to, anyway. So it's incredibly popular even now, and it's extremely atmospheric and gorgeous, but quite rough and cold and wet as well. The kind of fossils you find on the beach are things such as ammonites, which are, in Mary Anning's time, they called snake stones because they thought they resembled curled-up snakes with their heads missing. They didn't really know what they were, so they thought maybe there are snakes. The other common ones are called belemnites, which people used to say they were called thunderbolts, and they were what God threw down when lightning struck, and that was what made the noise. So there were all these folktales because, to be honest, people didn't know what fossils were. They didn't know if they were creatures that exist now or something that was some sort of strange rock formation, something that was inanimate. They had all kinds of theories and a lot of folk legends that grew up around it. Sometimes they also found things like this. Now, that in the center looks like a rock, really, but it isn't. It's it's what they used to call a vertebra. But people thought that they were crocodile's teeth, which is a little odd because crocodile's teeth are actually triangular or conical. But that is actually a vertebra of this ichthyosaur. Not this exact ichthyosaur, but it would have been one of the vertebrae along here. And you still find quite a lot of them on the beach. Now, in 1810, Mary Anning's father, Richard Anning, died, and he left the family absolutely destitute. They were 120 pounds in debt, which was a lot of money in those days. And soon after, Mary and her brother kept going on the beach looking for fossils, and they discovered the ichthyosaur. And after that, they sold it to the lord of the manor, who eventually sold it on to London, and it made its way into the British Museum. And now, if you go to London, if you go to the Natural History Museum, you can still find see the head of it. And, in fact, I believe you saw it the other day. If you read the paper, there was a big interview with me and that huge, rather huge photo of me standing, kneeling next to a big skull. That was the skull that Mary Anning and her brother discovered in 1810. But this book is not all about fossils. It's also about friendship, and specifically a friendship that developed between Mary and a woman named Elizabeth Philpott. When I was doing research on Mary, Elizabeth Philpott's name kept getting brought up again and again. But we know very little about her. We don't know what she looked like. All we know is she moved to London in 1805 when she was 25 and Mary was 5. So there's a 20-year age gap. She was middle class, and she lived with her two sisters, never married, lived with her two sisters in that pink house, the top bit of the pink house, which is now a hotel. And she was fascinated with fossil fish. She collected loads of them, has a gorgeous collection, which her descendants donated to Oxford University Natural History Museum. And you may look at that and say, that's not gorgeous, but it actually is. And I'm going to make you look at it for a little while, because I think that the more you look at it, the more beautiful and incredibly complicated you'll see it looks. I'd like to read now a section, the scene where Mary and Elizabeth meet for the first time. The two of them share the narration in this book, so the alternating chapters. And I'm going to read now a little bit where Elizabeth is first in Lyme Regis. We had not long been installed in Morley Cottage before I grew certain that fossils were to be my passion. For I had to find a passion. I was 25 years old, unlikely ever to marry, and in need of a hobby to fill my days. It is so tedious being a lady sometimes. My sisters had already claimed their territories. Louise was on her hands and knees in the Silver Street garden, pulling up hydrangeas, which she thought vulgar. Margaret was indulging her love of cards and dancing at Lyme's assembly rooms. For myself, it took only the early discovery of a golden ammonite glittering on the beach between Lyme and Charmouth for me to succumb to the seductive thrill of finding unexpected treasure. I began frequenting the beaches more and more, though at the time few women took an interest in fossils. It was seen as an unladylike pursuit, dirty and mysterious. I didn't mind. There was no one I wanted to impress with my femininity. Certainly, fossils are a peculiar pleasure. They do not appeal to everyone, for they are the remains of creatures. If you think on it too much, you would wonder at holding in your hands a long dead body. Then, too, they are not of this world, but from a past very difficult to imagine. That is why I'm drawn to them. It is fossils that first brought me in contact with Mary Anning and her family. I had hardly collected a handful of specimens before I decided I needed a cabinet in which to display them properly. I've always been the organizer amongst the Philpotts, the arranger of Louise's flowers and vases, the one to set out the china Margaret brought from London. This need to put things in order led me to Richard Anning's cellar workshop at the bottom of town. Though he had been recommended to me as a decent cabinet maker, I would soon have been drawn there anyway, if only to compare my fossils with those at the table young Mary Anning tended outside the workshop. She was a tall, lean child, with the hard limbs of a girl used to working rather than playing with her dollies. She had a rather plain, flat face, made interesting by bold brown eyes like pebbles. As I approached, she was sifting through a basket of specimens, picking out pieces of ammonites and tossing them into different bowls as if playing a game. Even at that early age, she was able to tell apart the various types of ammonites. She glanced up from her sorting, her look spirited and full of curiosity. "You want to buy curies, Mum? We got all types. Some beautiful ones here. Look, here's a pretty sea lily. Only a crown. I patted my basket. I have my own fossils, thank you. I'm here to see your father. Is he in? Mary nodded towards steps that led down to an open door. I ducked into a dim, filthy room, crammed with wood and stone, the floor covered with shavings and gritty dust. It smelled so strongly of varnish that I almost backed out. But I could not, for Richard Anning was staring at me, his sharp nose pinning me to the spot like a dart. I never like people who lead with their noses. They pull everything to the center of their faces, and I feel trapped by their concentration. He was a lithe man of medium height, with dark, lustrous hair and a strong jaw. His eyes were the kind of blue that hides things. It always annoyed me how handsome he was, given his harsh, teasing nature and his sometimes rough manners. He had not passed his looks on to his daughter, who might have had more use for them. He was perched over a small cabinet with glass doors, holding a brush coated with varnish. I took against Richard Anning from the start because he did not even set down the brush and barely glanced at my specimens as I described what I wanted. "A guinea," he announced. It was an outrageous figure for a specimen cabinet. Did he think he could take advantage of a London spinster? "It is a pity you have suggested such an exorbitant sum," I said, wrapping my fossils in muslin and placing them back in my basket. "I should have made your name prominent on each case, and everyone who looked at my collection would have seen it. Now, however, I shall have to go elsewhere, to someone more reasonable." "You going to show them to others?" Richard Anning nodded at my basket, his incredulity deciding me. "I would find someone in Axminster, or even Exeter if I had to, rather than give this man my business. I knew I would never like him." "Good day to you, sir," I said, turning to sweep up the steps. I was thwarted in my dramatic departure, however, by Mary, standing square in the entrance and blocking my way. "What curies you got?" she demanded, her eyes on my basket. "Clearly nothing that would be of interest to you," I muttered, pushing past her and out to the square. I hated being stung by Richard Anning's tone. Why should I care for a cabinet maker's opinion? In truth, I thought my bits and pieces rather fine for someone new to finding fossils. Now I could see, however, as I passed the Annings' table in my anger, that their fossils far exceeded mine in both variety and beauty. They were whole, polished, varied, and abundant. There were specimens displayed on the table I hadn't even known were fossils. Mary had ignored my rude remark and followed me out. "You got any vertebrates?" I paused, my back to her, the table, the whole wretched workshop. "What is a vertebrae?" I heard a rustling by the table, the clinking of stones knocked together. "From a crocodile's back," Mary said. "Some say they're the teeth, but Pa and I know better. See?" I turned to look at the stone she held out. It was about the size of a tuppence coin, though thicker, and round, but with squared-off sides. Its surface was concave, the center nipped in, as if someone had pressed it between two fingers while it was soft. I recalled the skeleton of a lizard I'd seen at the British Museum. "A vertebra," I corrected, holding the stone in my hand. "That is what you mean. But there are no crocodiles in England." "Just not seen them," Mary said. "Perhaps they've gone somewhere else, like to Scotland." When I went to hand back the vertebra, Mary glanced around to see her where her father was. "Keep it." "Thank you. What is your name?" "Mary." "That is very kind of you, Mary Anning. I shall treasure it." I did treasure it. It was the first fossil I put in my cabinet. Now you've had a good look at that fossil fish. Now, this ichthyosaur, yes, it's there. Why did this discovery have such an enormous impact on science and the way people looked at the world? Well, it helps to know a little bit about how people viewed the world at that time. In the early 19th century, there was no concept of deep time. Now we throw around the number 5 billion years old, the Earth being 5 billion years old, very blithely as if it's nothing. But it was not so long ago that people never would have thought that far ahead, that far back. There was no idea of prehistory. People were the beginning of history. Nothing happened before them, according to people of that time. And history was based on a literal interpretation of the Bible. The Bible is a history book. There was even a bishop, Bishop Usher, from Northern Ireland in the 17th century, who calculated all of the years in the Bible, all of the births and how long people lived, and worked out that the world was 6,000 years old, and that was widely accepted. So the belief was that the world was created in 6 days by God and set running. He created it and then pushed it off, and it was running, and it was... At what we see around us now is exactly as it was in Genesis, except for the flood, of course. Flood changed things a little bit, but not too much. It was very much... So all the animals that he created still exist. Science and religion, in fact, at that time, were even studied together. If you went to Oxford, and if you went to an Oxford only if you were a man, no women went at that time, Oxford or Cambridge... Men who studied science, they studied natural history, they studied geology. They also studied religion. So some of the big names in science at that time were also vicars or priests. There was no separation of science and religion. And in fact, a lot of these men spent their careers trying to keep the two together, trying to just use science to justify religion. There is very little questioning of these beliefs. The discovery of an ichthyosaur was threw a curveball into all of this, because the ichthyosaur was clearly something that didn't exist. When Mary Anning and her brother found it, they first thought it was a crocodile, but if you look at that huge eye, it's this big bulbous eye like a donut, or this like a pineapple ring it sometimes looks like. That's clearly not a crocodile's eye. And a crocodile doesn't have paddles. But this kind of creature, nobody had ever seen it before. So there are various theories that it lived off the coast of South America and we had just never seen it. But after a while, it became clear that there was such a thing. There were other animals discovered, the plesiosaur later on, and other discoveries in the fossil field that made scientists realize that actually there are animals out there that don't exist now. The idea of extinction was only introduced in 1812 by a French anatomist, Georges Cuvier, and that was seen as blasphemous. So it was quite how do you explain this? I'm going to read a scene now to give you an idea of how people would think about those ideas. Mary herself, being working class and uneducated, probably wouldn't, and also just spending most of her time on the beach trying to make a living, would not have spent time thinking about this too much. But Elizabeth could think about it. And that's partly, I think, why I have Elizabeth in the book, because she can give us a perspective on, a more educated perspective on what Mary was doing. Mary was also a genius, and sometimes you need to step back from a genius and have a more normal person like that who can look at her. So Elizabeth in some ways represents us, the normal readers, looking at this very unusual person. So I'm going to read a scene where Elizabeth has seen the skull of the ichthyosaur for the first time. It has no idea what it is, and she's very disturbed by it. After encountering... wait a minute. I don't want you to have to look at that the whole time. So you can look at some lovely ammonites. There we go. After encountering the skull the Annings had uncovered, I found it difficult to sleep, dreaming of the eyes of animals I had looked into, horses, cats, seagulls, dogs. There was a flatness in them, the lack of a God-given spark that frightened me into wakefulness. On Sunday, I remain behind after the service at St. Michael's, waving on my sisters. "I will catch you up," I said, and stood at the back of the church, waiting for the vicar to finish his goodbyes to the other parishioners. Reverend Jones was a plain man, with a boxy head and close-cropped hair, whose thin lips twisted and turned, even when every other part of him was still. I had not spoken with him except to mouth pleasantries, for he was uninspiring during services, his voice reedy, his sermons lackluster. However, he was a man of God, and I hoped he might be able to give me guidance. At last, only a girl remained behind, sweeping the floor. Reverend Jones is going up and down the pews, picking up hymn sheets and checking for gloves or prayer books left behind. He did not see me. Indeed, it felt as if he did not want to see me. His pastoral duties over for the day, he was doubtless thinking about the dinner he would soon sit down to and the sleep by the fire afterwards. When I cleared my throat and he looked up, he could not stop his mouth tightening into a brief grimace. "Miss Philpott, is this handkerchief yours?" He held out a ball of white cloth, probably hopeful that I could be easily dismissed. "I'm afraid not, Reverend Jones." "Ah, you're looking for something else then, perhaps, a purse, a button, a hairpin." "No, I wish to discuss a matter with you." "I see." Reverend Jones pushed out his lips. "My dinner will be ready soon, and I need to finish up here. You don't mind?" He continued along the pews, straightening cushions as I trailed behind. All the while, I could hear the scratch of the girl's broom on the floor. "I wanted to ask you what you thought of fossils." In trying to hold his attention, my voice came out louder than I had intended in the empty church. The sweeping stopped, but Reverend Jones continued up the aisle to the oak pulpit, where he picked up his own handkerchief and put it in his pocket. "What do I think of fossils, Miss Philpott? I do not think of them." "But you do know what they are." "They are skeletons that have been compressed by rock over time to become stone themselves. Most educated people know that." "But the skeletons, are they of creatures that still exist today?" Reverend Jones hurried to the altar and gathered up a set of candlesticks and the altar cloth. I felt like an idiot following him about. "Of course they exist," he said. "All the creatures God made exist." He opened a door in the aisle to the left of the altar, which led to a small back room where church bits and pieces were stored. I remained in the doorway while he shut candlesticks and cloth in a cupboard. "I'm afraid I don't understand your question, Miss Philpott," he called over his shoulder. I opened my purse and poured into my palm a few bits of fossils that had found their way there. Most of my pockets and purses held fossils. Reverend Jones' mouth twisted in disgust as he glanced at the contents. Ammonites, belemnite shafts, a chunk of fossilized wood, a length of crinoid stem. He reacted as if I had trailed horse dung into the church on my shoes. "Why on earth are you carrying those about?" I held out an ammonite. "I should like to know where the live versions of these are, Reverend Jones, for I have never seen one." As we gazed at the fossil, I felt for a moment that I was being sucked into its spiral, farther and farther back in time, until the past was lost in the center. Reverend Jones's response to the ammonite was more prosaic. "Perhaps you haven't seen them because they live out at sea, and their bodies only wash up after they die." He turned away and, pulling the door shut, locked it with a deft turn of a key, a gesture he seemed to enjoy. I stepped in front of him so that he could not hurry off to his dinner. Indeed, he could not move at all, but was pinned in the corner. "Have you heard about the crocodile head the Annings have found in the cliffs and are showing at the assembly rooms?" I asked. Reverend Jones forced himself to look straight at me. He had narrow eyes that seemed to be seeking a horizon, even when they were set on mine. "I know of it, yes. Have you seen it?" "I have no desire to see it." I was not surprised. Reverend Jones showed no curiosity about anything other than what would soon be on his plate. "The specimen does not look like any creature that lives now," I said. "Someone, a member of this congregation, in fact, has suggested that it is an animal that God rejected in favor of a better design." Reverend Jones looked aghast. "Who said that?" "It's not important who said it. I just wondered if there was any truth in the theory." Reverend Jones brushed down the sleeves of his coat and pursed his lips. "Miss Philpott, I am surprised. I thought you and your sisters were well versed in the Bible." "We are. Let me make it clear. You need only to look to Scripture for answers to your questions. Come." He led the way back to the pulpit where the Bible he had read from lay. As he began flipping through the pages, the girl approached. "Reverend Jones, sir, I done the sweeping." "Thank you, Fanny." Reverend Jones regarded her for a moment, then said, "There is something I would like you to do for me, child. Come over to the Bible. I want you to read something out to Miss Philpott. There's another penny in it for you. He turned to me. Fanny Miller and her family joined St. Michael's a few years ago from the Congregationalists, for they were deeply disturbed by the Annings fossil hunting. The Church of England is clearer in its biblical interpretation than some of the dissenters' churches. You have found much comfort here, haven't you, Fanny? Fanny nodded. She had wide, crystal blue eyes topped with smooth, dark eyebrows that contrasted with her fair hair. She would never lead with her eyes, though they were her best feature, but with her brow, which was wrinkled with apprehension as she gazed at the Bible. Don't be frightened, Fanny, Reverend Jones said to soothe her. You are a very good reader. I've heard you at Sunday school. Start here. He laid a finger on a passage. She read in a halting whisper. And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let fowl multiply in the earth. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. Excellent, Fanny. You may stop there. I thought he had finished patronizing me by having an ignorant girl read out from Genesis, but Reverend Jones himself continued, and God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast of the earth after his kind, and it was so. I stopped listening after a few lines. I knew them anyway, and couldn't bear his oboe voice, which lacked the depth one expected of a man in his position. I actually preferred Fanny's unschooled recitation. While he read, I let my eyes rest on the page. To the left of the biblical words were annotations in red of Bishop Usher's chronological calculations of the Bible. According to him, God created heaven and earth on the night preceding the 23rd of October, 4004 B.C. I had always wondered at his precision. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. When Reverend Jones finished, we were silent. You see, Miss Philpott, it really is very simple, Reverend Jones said. He seemed much more confident now that he had the Bible with him. All that you see about him is as God set it out in the beginning. He did not create beasts and then get rid of them. That would suggest he had made an error. And of course, God is all-knowing and incapable of error, is he not? I suppose not, I conceded. You suppose not? Of course not, I said quickly. I'm sorry, it's just that I'm confused. You are saying that everything we see around us is exactly as God created it, are you not? The mountains and the sea and the rocks and hills, the landscape is as it was at the beginning. Of course. Reverend Jones looked around at his church, tidy and quiet. We are done here, aren't we, Fanny? Yes, Reverend Jones. But I was not done. So, every rock we see is as God created it at the beginning, I persisted. And the rocks came first, as it says in Genesis, before the animals. Yes, yes, Reverend Jones was becoming impatient, his mouth chewing an imaginary straw. If that is the case, then how did the skeletons of the animals get inside the rocks and become fossils? If the rocks were already created by God before the animals, how is it that there are bodies inside the rocks? Reverend Jones stared at me, his mouth at last stilled into a tight, straight line. Fanny Miller's forehead was a field of furrows. One of the pews creaked in the stillness. God placed the fossils there when he created the rocks to test our faith, he responded at last, as he is clearly testing yours, Miss Philpott. It is my faith in you that is being tested, I thought. Now, I really am very late for my dinner, Reverend Jones continued. He picked up the Bible, a gesture that seemed to suggest he thought I might steal it. Do not ask me difficult questions, he might as well have said. I never again mentioned fossils to Reverend Jones. Now, thank you. Nope, it's okay. I wanted to talk, just before I read the final scene, I'd like to talk just a little bit about my research method. I do a lot of reading, but I also like to do what I call on-the-job training. And when I wrote Girl with a Pearl Earring, I took a painting class. When I wrote The Lady and the Unicorn, which is about tapestries, I visited a tapestry studio several times. With Remarkable Creatures, if I'm going to write about someone fossil hunting, I've got to do the fossil hunting myself. There are still plenty of fossils to be found on the beaches at Lyme Regis and plenty of fossil hunters. I went out myself, found very few, and then I enlisted the help of a wonderful man named Patty Howe, who, if you ever go to Lyme Regis and you go to his fossil workshop, he'll take you on a guided walk where you too will find fossils. And he was wonderful. He and I, one February 2007, he called me and he said, we'd been out a couple times, and he said, I think, an ichthyosaur jaw in the ledges off of Church Cliffs here. Do you want to come out and help me get it out? And he said, the thing is, it's way out, and the tide only goes that far out 2 days a month. So we have to go on these days, and we only have an hour. He enlisted a friend of his, and we went out, and we went out. It was a day like this. We took pictures this day, and it was absolutely frigid. It was cold. It was kind of rainy, and Patty took us to this. I went with my husband and son, so we all went, and he said, oh, there it is, and I said, where? And we couldn't find it. He said, there, and I thought, yeah, where? And he said, there, and this is apparently a dinosaur's teeth, ichthyosaur's tooth right there and there. And you have to have an incredibly good eye. So he's been doing it for years, and that's the thing you have to build up over time. That's why you don't find fossils right away. You have to spend a lot of time on the beach doing it. So we began digging it out. This is the conditions under which we were working, very, very muddy, raw, and cold. And I kept thinking of Mary Anning as I was doing this, and I was thinking, I'm wearing Gore-Tex and nice warm clothes, and I have Wellingtons on, so I'm not going to get my feet wet. And Mary Anning wore wool and leather. She must have been sodden and full of mud the whole time. You get your hands incredibly muddy, and it's heavy. And look at his hands. Patty's hands are just unbelievably cut up, and just the embedded clay under his nails. And if you think of a woman at that time who was supposed to get married, having hands like that, No. And so she and Elizabeth never married. I'm not surprised. They were both very unusual, slightly outside of society, deeply eccentric. This is us finding it. And then eventually they carried it back like on a stretcher. And it is incredibly heavy. And Mary Anning had to get men in, quarrymen, to help her. And they would dig it out. She would help them. They'd dig it. And then they'd carry it back extremely heavy in pieces. Finally, several months later, the thing is, once you get it out of the rock, you then have to clean it and prepare it and set it in cement like that. And that was a few months later. So there's a lot more work that has to be done inside the workshop. And Patty used to send me things to clean just as homework. So he was an extremely good teacher. Now, at that cliff, it was a really great place to find, for him to have found something, because this is the place where Mary first found the ichthyosaur. And I want to read, finally, a scene of something that took place a couple of years after the ichthyosaur discovering it. And it shows you a little bit, this is from Mary's point of view, what can happen to you out on the beach. It's not always fun and games. It's quite dangerous at times. After she found the ichthyosaur, men started coming down, middle-class men started coming down, asking her to take them out on the beach to look for specimens. And when she was a teenager, this was seen as inappropriate for her to be on her own. And so she used to get chaperone. And this is a chaperone you will recognize. Now, I have to also tell you that when I wrote this scene, as I was writing this scene, the same thing that happens to her happened on the beach. Although nobody was hurt. And I was really surprised by that serendipity. So things are happening over and over again. My trade is best done in bad weather. Rain flushes fossils out of the cliffs, and storms scrub the ledges clean of seaweed and sand so more can be seen. I never minded the cold or the wet, as long as I was finding curies. William Buckland also wanted to go out, even when it was raining. Fanny Miller had to come with us and would huddle wretched in her shawl, curling up amongst the boulders to shelter against the wind. We were often the only folk upon beach then, for in poor weather, visitors preferred to go to the bathhouses, which had heated water, or to play cards and read the papers at the assembly rooms, or to drink at the Three Cups. Only serious hunters went out in the rain. One rainy day, towards the end of summer, I was upon beach with Mr. Buckland and Fanny. There was no one else on that stretch of shore, though our rival, Captain Curie, passed by at one point, nosing about to see what we were doing. Mr. Buckland had discovered a ridge of bumps not far from where we dug out the jaw in Church Cliffs and thought they might be a row of vertebrae from the same animal. I was chiseling away at it to try and uncover the bones when Mr. Buckland left my side. After a minute, Fanny came to stand close by, and I knew Mr. Buckland must be pissing in the water. He was always careful not to embarrass me and slipped off to do his business far enough away that I didn't have to see. I was used to him doing that, but it always bothered Fanny, and it were the one time she'd come up to the cliff by me. I felt sorry for her. The rain was coming down hard and dripping on her face from her bonnet rim. It was too wet for her to sew or knit, and there's nothing worse than having nothing to do in the rain. "Why don't you just turn away when he's down there?" I said, trying to be helpful. "He's not going to wave it in your face. He's too much of a gentleman for that." Fanny shrugged. "You ever seen one?" she said after a moment. I think it was the first question she'd asked me in 10 years. "Just my brother's," I said, "when he were little. You?" I didn't think she would answer, but then she said, "Once at the Three Cups, a man got so drunk he dropped his trousers in the kitchen, thinking it were the privy." We both laughed. For a second, I wondered if we might be starting to get on better. We'd no chance for that. There were no warning, no pebbles raining down, or the groan of stone splitting from stone. It were that sudden that one moment Fanny and I were laughing about men's parts by the cliff, and the next cliff dropped, and I was knocked down and buried in the thick rocky clay. There was a long, long time when nothing happened. Then I heard a scrabbling and felt hands clawing at me and wiping my eyes, and I opened them and saw Mr. Buckland's terrified face, and I thought maybe I would not meet God yet. "Oh, Mary," he cried. "Sir, get me out." Mr. Buckland pulled at the rocks and mud, but could not move them. "It's too heavy, Mary. I can't get you out with no tools." He was in a kind of daze, as if he couldn't think straight. We heard a cry then. We had forgot about Fanny. She was just a few feet from us, so weren't so heavily buried as me, but there was blood on her face. She began to scream, and Mr. Buckland jumped up and went over to her. The clay was loose around her, and he managed to shift it enough so that he could pull her out. He wiped the blood from her face, and in doing so knocked out the bonnet from her head, for he was scared and clumsy. It got caught up in a gust of wind and rolled away down the beach. Losing her bonnet seemed to upset Fanny more than anything else. "My bonnet," she cried. "I need my bonnet. Ma'am will kill me if I lose it." Then she screamed again as Mr. Buckland tried to move her. "Her leg is broken," Mr. Buckland said. "I'm going to have to leave you to get help." At that moment, part of the cliff farther along crumbled and crashed to the ground. Fanny screamed again. "Don't leave me, sir. Please don't leave me." I didn't want to be left either, but I didn't cry out. "Best to carry her, sir, if you can. At least you can save one of us." Mr. Buckland looked horrified. "Oh, I don't think I should do that. It wouldn't be proper." It seemed even he, who ate field mice and carried a bright blue sack and pissed in the sea, was uneasy about holding a girl in his arms. "Put an arm around her shoulders and one under her knees and lift, sir," I coached. "She's a little thing. You should be able to carry her, even a scholar like you." Mr. Buckland did what I said and heaved Fanny into his arms. She screamed again, in pain and shame. Letting her arms flop wide, she turned her head away from him. "For God's sake, Fanny, put your arms round him," I cried. "Help the man, or he'll never get you back." Fanny obeyed me, throwing her arms round his neck and burying her face against his chest. "Take her to the bathhouse, that's the closest place, and send people straight back with spades. Please, and hurry, please, sir. I can't bear being alone like this." As he nodded, another section of cliff fell away with a crash, and Mr. Buckland flinched. I fastened my eyes on his. "Sir, pray for me. And if I die, tell Ma'am and Joe..." "Don't say such a thing, Mary. I'll be back shortly." Mr. Buckland staggered away, Fanny gazing at me with glazed eyes over his shoulder. Later, Dr. Carpenter would set her leg, but the break was awkward and never healed properly, and left her with one leg shorter than the other. She could never walk far or stand for long, and could never again come out upon beach, not that she would want to. Whenever I saw her hobbling down Broad Street to the Three Cups, I ducked my head to avoid that fearful blue gaze. Of course, I didn't know any of that then, held fast in the landslip. I watched Mr. Buckland weaving down the beach with his burden, not going fast enough for me, and wondered why it was that the pretty ones were always rescued before the plane. That was how the world worked. With her big eyes and dainty features, Fanny did not get stuck, whereas I was caught in the mud, the cliff threatening to crumble on top of me. I closed my eyes and said a long prayer for God to spare me, to let me live on to help Mam and Joe, to find more crocodiles, to have enough to eat and coal to burn, even to have a husband and children one day. And please God, make Mr. Buckland a runner rather than a walker today. Make him find someone quick and come back. It was quiet now. The wind had died down, and a fine misty rain sprayed my face. Now and then I heard the faint skitter of more debris tumbling down the cliff to the ground. I couldn't see it because they were behind me, and I couldn't turn my head all the way around. That was the worst, hearing it and not knowing how close it was or if it would bury me. The mud that held me was cold and heavy and pressing on my chest, making it hard to breathe. I looked down the beach towards Charmouth. There were no boats out or fishermen checking crab pots, for it was too rough. There was no one at all, and the tide had turned and was slowly creeping up. I gave up looking for help and began to notice things closer to me. The landslip had caused a churning up of rocks caught in an ooze of blue-gray clay. My eyes flicked over the stones near to me and come to rest on a familiar shape about 4 feet from me, a ring of overlapping bony scales the size of my fist, a crocodile's eye. It were like it was staring straight at me. I cried out with the surprise of seeing it. Then, several feet past the eye, there was a movement. It was only tiny, but I cried out again, and it moved again. It was just a little pink spot sticking out of the clay, and with the rain in my eyes, it was hard to see what it was. I wondered if it were a crab scrabbling about in the mud. "Hey," I called, and it moved. It was not a crab, but a finger. I felt so relieved and sick at the same time, I think I fainted. When I come to, I looked at the spot again, and it wasn't moving. "Who's that?" I called. The finger moved. I was so happy not to be alone that I laughed aloud. "Joe? Is it Joe?" The finger didn't move. "Ma'am? Miss Philpott?" No movement. I knew it wouldn't have been any of them, for I would have known if they were upon beach. But who else would be out in such weather? I supposed it could have been one of the children from Lyme, come to spy on me and Mr. Buckland, hoping to see something scandalous they could report back on. But it seemed unlikely. We would have spotted them if they were upon beach, unless they'd been up on the cliff, which meant they'd come down with the slip. It was a miracle they were alive. I was thinking of the cliff and the landslips that made me realize who it must be. Captain Curie? I remember now. I'd seen him earlier. Even as the finger wriggled, I saw the handle of his spade poking out of the clay that had buried him. I was so glad he was there that any spite I felt towards him vanished. "Captain Curie! Mr. Buckland's gone to get help. They'll be back to dig us out." The finger moved, but less than before. "Was you up on the cliff and come down with the slip?" The finger didn't move. "Captain Curie, can you hear me? Are your bones broke? Fanny's leg is broke, I think. Mr. Buckland's taken her with him. He'll be back soon." I was chattering on to mask my terror. The finger stayed stiff, pointing up at the sky. I knew what that meant. I began to cry. "Please stay, Captain Curie. Don't go." Between me and Captain Curie, the croc eye watched us both. "Captain Curie and I are going to be like the croc," I thought. "We will become fossils, trapped upon beach forever." After a while, I stopped looking at Captain Curie's finger, now still as any rock caught in the clay. I couldn't bear to watch the tide steadily rising. Instead, I gazed up into the flat white sky, a few pewter clouds swimming about in it, After spending so much of my life looking down at stones, it was strange to look up into emptiness. I spotted a gull circling high above and kept my eyes fixed on it and did not look at the finger or the crock again. It was so quiet, I wanted to make a noise to break the spell. I wanted the lightning to pass through me and jolt me into life, for I was feeling the opposite of that sensation. A slow darkness was creeping through my body. There had been plenty of deaths in our family, Pa and all the children. I had spent most of my time collecting what were dead bodies of animals, but I had not thought much of my own death before. Now I was finding that dying was no drama. Dying was cold and hard and painful and dull. It went on too long. I was exhausted and growing bored with it. Now I had too much time to think about whether I was going to die from the tide coming in and drowning me, or the mud pressing the air out of me as it had Captain Curie, or a falling rock striking me. I couldn't think for long or it hurt too much, like touching a piece of ice. I tried to think of God instead and how he would help me through it. It was hard to breathe now with the mud so heavy. My breathing got slower, and so did the beat of my heart, and I closed my eyes. When I come to, someone was digging the clay around me. I opened my eyes and smiled. Thank you. I knew you would come. Oh, thank you for coming to me. And if you want to find out who saved her, you have to read the book. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. I've run over a bit, but I'm sure we have some time for questions, so I'll put it on there now. If you would like have any questions, there are microphones going up and down, so just raise your hand and I'll point to you and wait until the microphone's reached you. Does anyone have a question? Oh, I've stunned you into submission. Oh, way back there. Somebody's got a Rebecca. Sir in the back, or ma'am in the back. Can't see.
Okay, I'd just like to know if... First, it was a really good book. You did a really good job.
Thank you.
I'd just like to know, how long did it actually take you to write the book?
It took me 2.5 years. I did about 6 months of research before I started writing the book, started writing the story. And once I started writing the story, then other questions came up. So the research and the writing are pretty intertwined. They go on side by side. And it really depends on the subject matter. Some books have taken 3 years, and then Girl with the Pearl Earring only took a year because I was pregnant while I was writing it, so wanted to get it done. And there's nothing like a biological deadline to kind of focus the mind. I think my publisher is hoping I'd have a child every time I had a book due, but no, it didn't happen that way. But yeah, it just depends, but this one took about 2.5 years. Any lady in the front has a question?
You did such a wonderful job of capturing, I guess you did a good job of capturing the way people kind of thought and phrased things in the early 1800s. How did you get hold of that? How did you find out?
How people spoke?
How people spoke.
It wasn't difficult in that my last book, very conveniently, Burning Bright, was set in the 1790s. And one of the families in the book is from Dorset, which is the area where this book is set. And so I had already done some research into how people would have sounded then. So this followed on only 10 years later. And I very cunningly, first of all, Thomas Hardy set lots of books there. And so his novels have a tendency, he writes almost in dialect. And if you read enough of him, you get a bit of a sense of how people talked. But there also happened to be a 19th century poet named William Barnes who lived in Dorset and wrote poetry in dialect, and he also wrote a grammar about how people talked. So I had a lot of resources. But having said that, I learned all that, and the first draft, Mary in particular, well, Mary is a Dorset girl, so I laid it on really thick, and then I realized it was way too thick. So I spent a lot of editing time pulling out what I did. And what I tend to like to do is to make a, I don't want it to sound oldie-worldie or too, it just doesn't work. You know, I'm not Thomas Hardy. And so what I try to do is write a very straightforward, stripped-down prose, but I take little verbal tics and add them in. For instance, we know that Mary used to say, I went to Palm Beach. She'd take out the. And so I kept that one. And people in Dorset at that time sometimes would play around, would reverse. They'd say, I were going instead of I was going. And so I used those. I used it way too much in the first draft, but I kept taking them out. So now you just get a kind of sprinkling of it, just to remind you that she sounded different, not only different from us, but different from Elizabeth Philpott, who was middle class and from London. And Elizabeth, I kind of copied on Jane Austen. She's Jane Austen modified, so you just have to reread your Jane Austen, and then, so that was a lot of fun. Great research, that. Any other questions? Yes, right here.
In Girl with the Pearl Earring, could you talk about the character of Frit and how much you had to go on, or how, if you had nothing to go on and created her, sort of how the germ of that book and how it developed?
Sure. Girl with the Pearl Earring, you probably know because most of you have read it, is based on a painting by Vermeer of the same name. And I had a poster of that painting up in my house, in my bedroom, for years and years and years before I had the idea for the book. And I'd always, it's a very simple portrait of a girl wearing a turban, yellow and blue turban, and wearing a pearl earring with huge eyes and turned this way. And I always could never tell whether she was smiling and happy or really sad. Because sometimes she seemed one or the other. Sometimes she seemed really innocent, and other times like she had been through a lot. And one day I was lying there looking at it, and I just suddenly thought, I wonder what Vermeer, the painter, did to her or said to her to make her look like that. And it was the first time that I had acknowledged that the look on her face might have something to do with the painter and not with just the way she was, that actually her expression, what it was, is a portrait of a relationship rather than a portrait of her that we're seeing in her face. And I thought, wow, I wonder what their relationship was. There's a story to write about. So I had a look to see what we knew. We know very little about Vermeer, but we know absolutely nothing about her. Nobody knows who he painted. There are a lot of theories that he painted his family over and over, and he did have six daughters or whatever, so it could have been a daughter, but his eldest daughter at the time would have been 12, and I just had a feeling she seemed older to me and more experienced, a little bit more. And also, she had her mouth open, and there's something, and it's glistening. There's something incredibly sensual about it all, sexual about it all, or erotic. And I just didn't think a father would paint his daughter in that way. So I thought, I don't know who she is. Nobody knows who she is, so I can make up whatever I want, which is great. It was perfect for me, you know. I would never have written about her if I'd known that she was his daughter. So I had to decide who she would be, and from that the story would come. And the way I decided what she was is, you know, it seems like a very simple painting, but there's a lot of little detail in it that's quite contradictory. She's wearing very plain clothes, and yet and most of the women in Vermeer's paintings were wearing fur, velvet, satin, rich stuff. She's wearing plain clothes, but she's wearing a pearl earring. And I thought, well, those are probably her clothes, but that can't be her earring. So whose earring is it? And we happen to know that Vermeer's wife had certain clothes. We have a list of them. And we see them. There's like a yellow and black bodice. There's a blue house coat with white fur, various things like that, that you see different women throughout his paintings wearing. So there was a tradition of Vermeer's wife lending her clothes to models. And I thought, okay, that's not her earring. It's his wife's earring. And I thought, well, who is she? She seems to me emotionally close to him, to the painter. So it's somebody, if it's not his daughter, then who is it? Somebody who's actually physically there a lot. Neighbor, how about a servant? A servant. And that was how it developed. So I had the servant, I had the fact that she's wearing the wife's earring. She's very beautiful. Vermeer would have had to spend a lot of time with her, probably alone, because she's so still and quiet. You're not going to have a lot. I mean, I He had 11 children, but by the time he painted this painting, he had 5 children. It was a noisy household, so I thought, if it's a noisy household, then you're going to have to set him aside. He's going to have his studio, and I bet you he said, right, this door stays closed, nobody comes in here except me, and oh, the maid can come in to clean. And then he painted her. So they were alone together. She was beautiful. He was a man. And then she was wearing his wife's earring, and I thought, there's the story right there. It just all developed out of a very simple painting. So that was how I came up with the idea. Do we have time for maybe one more question? There's a lady in the back, so if you can run back. Yes, sorry, I've run over, but one last question, make it a good one. See, I'm gonna pile on the pressure, take it off of me.
This kind of piggybacks on the other question. When you are writing about a real person like Vermeer or Mary Anning, how do you kind of reconcile what the character you want them to be with what you know about them as an actual person? Has there ever been a conflict or anything like that?
There is sometimes a conflict. I usually choose people who are known but not known very well. So there's a lot of gaps in their biography. And also I tend to choose people who I'm quite taken with their personalities anyway. But there are occasionally times when I feel I have to, especially like the timeline of someone's life is, you know, we live our lives not as novels, and sometimes there are long patches where nothing happens. And so I was always having to work around that. So what I've tended to have problems with is the actual arc of the story, and having the arc of their lives somehow match that. Not always easy. And in fact, with this book, Mary's life, a lot of it was day after day on the beach for years doing the same thing over and over and over again, and that does not make a novel, or not the kind of novel I can write. The first draft had dates in it, and there were patches where I thought, oh, God, 2 years passes here. The reader isn't going to buy that. They think it happened in a much shorter time, and then my solution was to strip out the dates. So there's only a couple dates in here, so it's all kind of ever so slightly, you know, I have modified it, and I do say that in the afterword, afternote, that some things have been stretched and condensed, and it's more doing that rather than cutting things out altogether. On that note, I think we have run out of time, but I am delighted to have been here. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you. Thank you.
Get you right off.
Oh, yes, so you don't forget.
Well, I also